This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
We just need a strategy, okay?
Okay, here's the plan.
Matt Clark of the Foundation for Moral Law joins us to discuss some Supreme Court decisions. We start there on Tactics. Good morning, everybody. Welcome to Tactics. Happy Thursday to one and all. I'm your humble host, Caleb Colquitt. As always, it is a joy to be able to speak with you this morning. Hope that you are well. We do have quite a bit to get through. Most of you have probably noticed that I've done something rare this week, if you have been paying attention to this show for some time, which is several really big Supreme Court decisions came out this week. Lots of Supreme Court news. And I have thoroughly covered none of it. Well, the reason for that is because I wanted to bring in somebody who's an expert, and we do have one of the best here from the Foundation of Moral Law. Matt Clark is with me this morning in studio. Good morning, Matt. Did I say Mark?
You did. Hey, you know what? Yeah. That's okay. I'm used to it. I get called Mike and Mark all the time. It's all good.
If it were somebody I just met, I would forgive myself a little more, but I've actually known you for a while, so I should have got the name right.
It's all good, man. I've been called a lot worse.
Well, me too, usually by the callers. But anyway, and actually, we have a live studio audience here. Laura Gladwell, my former co-host, is also in studio today, so... it's good to have. We should have a studio audience every day. We should have like a big seating platform with a live audience. Maybe get some reactions like a Cosby Show or, you know, one of those other sitcoms from the 80s.
You have me here.
Well, that's true. I do usually have you.
You just take me for granted.
Tell us a little bit about yourself, Matt.
Well, I'm originally from the People's Republic of Maryland. Fortunately, when I grew up and was able to move away, I escaped and made my way down to eventually to Alabama, where people still have their heads screwed on straight. So I feel very fortunate to be here. But yeah, born and raised in Maryland, right outside of D.C. Went to college and law school at Liberty University in Virginia, one of the few Christian and conservative law schools in the country. You know, we got
largest Christian university in the country, isn't it?
Yeah, that's correct. That's correct. So, I mean, there are only a few out there. You know, grateful that we have one right here in Montgomery with, you know, Faulkner University and Thomas Jones School of Law. But yeah, after graduating law school, I got the opportunity to come work for Chief Justice Moore of the Alabama Supreme Court as a law clerk. That was only supposed to last for about a year and a half, but you know, I guess it didn't screw it up too bad because he offered to keep me on permanently and stuck around with him until, unfortunately, he was removed. You know, back in September, and shortly right after that, myself and two other staff attorneys were fired by a slim majority of the court. But the Lord was good to us. Within a couple weeks, got the offer to come on at the Foundation for Moral Law, and it's been a great gig since. So,
right, Justice Moore started that, but he's no longer working with it, correct?
That's correct. That's correct. He's our founder. The people that know us nationwide know us because of the stand that he took for the Ten Commandments back in 2003 and more recently over marriage. But that's correct. He's currently running for United States Senate right now, and he's kind of left the running the foundation to us. So,
well, we love the foundation here at News Radio 1440 because y'all are right almost across the street from us, and so we usually try to get y'all for legal analysis, and of course today is no exception. So just before we get into the meat of what we're going to talk about, give us a little introduction about how you got into constitutional law. What about that interested you?
Well, that's a long story. I'll try to keep it brief. So I was always interested in big picture things, just trying to figure out, you know, what's really going on in a particular case, you know. So when, for instance, when the U.S. Supreme Court comes out and says certain things like, you know, you have pretty much the guaranteed right to an abortion in the first trimester, kind of in the second, but not really in the third, it leaves me scratching my head wondering how in the world did they get to that conclusion, you know. So that was just one example. When I was in college, I thought I was going to try to run for office one day. So I was a government major and I was focusing on the policy side of things. But The more I studied, the more I came to realize the issues that were closest to my heart had been messed up by the courts, not by the legislatures. You know, so take abortion, for instance. At the time Roe v. Wade was decided, I think it was less than 10 states in the union had legalized abortion.
Right.
But all of a sudden, the U.S. Supreme Court comes along and says, based on the due process clause of the 14th Amendment, that they came up with this framework that you read the text and you wonder, how did you get to that conclusion? There is no rational way you can get there. I studied that, things like, you know, separation of church and state issues, free exercise of religion. And the more I studied, the more I realized, I think, you know, one of the biggest threats to the country at home is the courts. And I feel like that's where we're getting killed. So that's, I kind of came to the conclusion, if I want to do something about this, then, you know, I have to study constitutional law, become a lawyer, and take the opportunities available to get in that fight.
Right. So what Thomas Jefferson warned us about, judicial tyranny, essentially, is what you're talking about. And so we're certainly glad to have you. And it's interesting that you gave us some of that reasoning, because some of the rationale you're using in there and what got you into constitutional law is actually some of the things we're going to be talking about today, which is good. So I wanted to go ahead and start out, and I thought that our audience would probably be most interested in this first case, the Masterpiece Cake Shop. Just give us a little bit of background on that, how they came to the decision that they did, and do a little explanation there for us, for the people who might not be aware of that case.
Sure, absolutely. In my opinion, I think this is going to be the most important religious liberty case that the U.S. Supreme Court has ever taken up. So as I'm sure most of the audience knows, 2 years ago, the U.S. Supreme Court legalized same-sex marriage in the case of Obergefell v. Hodges. And a lot of people, including several of the dissenting justices on the Supreme Court, said this is going to cause an inevitable collision with religious liberty. You know, what's going to happen when, let's say, you have a clerk for a county like Kim Davis, who says, I can't issue marriage licenses to you because of my religious beliefs, or a business that says, hey, listen, I'll serve you when you come in for regular business, but I can't cater to, you know, a gay wedding specifically. And that's exactly what happened in this case. So it came out of Colorado, and it involved a small bakery called Masterpiece Cake Shop, and it's owned by a guy named Jack Phillips, who's a Christian, been a Christian for about 35 years, and he believes that the Bible teaches that marriage is between one man and one woman, and that's it. So back in 2012, interestingly enough, even before Obergefell came out, there were two gay people who came into his shop and asked him to bake a cake for his wedding, and he politely declined and said, I'm sorry, look, I'm happy to serve you guys. Just about, you know, anything else, but I can't, you know, make a cake for this wedding because I can't get on board with it morally. Well, they filed a complaint with the Colorado Civil Rights Commission, and the commission eventually cracked down on him and held that he has to bake the cake for them. That went up to the Colorado Court of Appeals, and the Court of Appeals affirmed. So Phillips, I think, had some very good arguments in his favor. He said, look, this violates my right to free speech because you're essentially forcing me to say something that I don't want to say. And it is pretty well settled that the right to free speech also includes the right not to speak. All right. You know, so, you know, you are free to say what you want, and you're also free to refrain from speaking about things that are offensive to you. It also said this violates my rights to free exercise of religion, and the Colorado Court of Appeals, in a very poorly reasoned opinion, just rejected all of his arguments and held that we have to go ahead and bake the cake. So that came up to the U.S. Supreme Court, and he was begging the U.S. Supreme Court to take the case. And what they did this past week was they agreed to take it up. So
right,
far,
not a decision yet, but they have agreed to look at the case.
Correct. That's right. So. They're going to be considering a few things like free speech arguments. You know, this involve Mr. Phillips' right to free speech, free exercise of religion. And given the way that the U.S. Supreme Court has handed down decisions, especially on free speech issues, I think Phillips has a very strong case. But what I want to point out is that this is not just about Jack Phillips, all right? This is about any Christian that has a moral opposition to same-sex marriage in business. Because whatever decision the Supreme Court makes is going to affect everybody else. So if you say, listen, I don't hate gay people, you know, and if they come into my shop for just about anything else, I'll go ahead.
Yeah,
and
buy
them.
Something off the shelf if you want.
Exactly. Exactly, but I cannot craft a message celebrating something that I believe is morally wrong.
We've seen a lot of cases like this, and we do have to go to a break here in just a second, but we've seen cases like this in New York where you had a couple that the courts ruled they had to host a gay wedding in their own home because they offer weddings to other people in their house. We saw the same thing with the Oregon Bakers, and so this is a case that has long-reaching implications in this country, and we're going to be keeping an eye on it. We're going to give you more on that, a little bit of discussion. We'll be back with Matt Clark of the Foundation for Moral Law in just a moment.
This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
The doctrines of Jesus are simple and tend all to the happiness of man. Thomas Jefferson.
Welcome back. You are listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com. 860-1440 are the numbers. We are back with Matt Clark of the Foundation of Moral Law. He is with us, constitutional law specialist. So we're talking a little bit about the Masterpiece Cake Shop, and for those of you who may just be joining us, this was the court deciding that they are going to hear a very important case when it comes to religious liberty. They've decided to hear this case out, which it's a case very similar to the ones that we've talked about here on the program before, where there is a Christian florist or baker or photographer that a gay couple wants to participate in their wedding, and they say, well, I have religious objections to that, so I can't do it. And a court case ensues for discrimination. So this case is very similar to that. It's kind of almost run-of-the-mill when it comes to that. So, Matt, get us a little up to speed on that. How significant is it? Like, was this something that you were expecting? How significant is it that they decided to actually hear this case out?
I think it's incredibly significant. One of the problems that we saw in the aftermath of their decision in 2013 in the United States v. Windsor, which was one of the first gay marriage cases, struck down the Defense of Marriage Act at the federal level, and it really left open the question of whether the states can define marriages between one man and one woman. What happened was, for the next 2 years in the aftermath of Windsor, the court kept declining to hear same-sex marriage cases that came up. And then what happened was all of the lower federal courts and a lot of state Supreme Courts started striking down marriage amendments as one man and one woman as unconstitutional. And then when one federal circuit finally upheld it, that's when the court took the case up and reversed. So getting out of the legalese and back to plain English here, that's something that always scares me a little bit, is when the court makes a bad decision like it did in Obergefell. A lot of times it lets the lower courts do its dirty work in taking it to the next step. And then once all the lower courts do that, it finally takes the case up and says, oh, hey, the country is okay with this now. It's like, no, the country's not okay with this now. Unelected, unaccountable federal judges, got behind you, and then, you decided to affirm everything. In contrast, in Masterpiece Cake Shop, they decided to take this case up almost immediately after it decided Obergefell v. Hodges 2 years ago. So these cases involving the clash between so-called gay rights and religious liberty is pretty new. And so the fact that the Supreme Court is jumping on this immediately, I would say, is a good sign. It shows that they're concerned about this issue, that they're not just going to punt, that they're not going to let a lot of the lower courts do their dirty work, but they're going to go ahead and make a decision on it immediately. So it is entirely possible that after they hear the case, they could wind up finding a way to punt. In this particular case, one of the problems was there were just a lot of very basic legal violations in how a lawsuit is supposed to proceed. So, for instance, Jack Phillips, the owner of the cake shop, was not properly named as a party. He was not really served with all the proper paperwork at the beginning of the lawsuit. So I'm thinking, if the court doesn't really want to tackle the tough issue of what you do with religious liberties and gay marriage clashing, they can take the middle road and punt on this case. They could just say, well, it's not really the heart of the case, but there is a procedural due process issue here where, he wasn't really served. He didn't get all the process that is due to him under the Constitution. So we're just going to reverse in this particular case. But it's not, if they do that, it's not going to answer the broader question of what do you do in cases where, religious freedom and rights of free speech clash with gay rights. So
they could essentially decide this case on a technicality as opposed to answering the underlying question that this case represents.
Bingo. Yeah, they do that. They do that all the time, and it's sad. Some of the more principled justices, like Justice Thomas, formerly Justice Scalia, and I believe Justice Gorsuch, who so far is doing a fine job. I think
right. We don't have a huge sample size, but so far his decisions have been solid.
Exactly. It looks like he's in lockstep with how Scalia used to rule. So that's a good sign. Mm-hmm. You know, they would probably call the court out and say you need to address the underlying issue here. You know, forget punting, and you know, we need to go ahead and decide the big issue right now. But the rest of the court, you know, if they want to get out of this, there are ways to do that.
You know, I found this fascinating. Now, of course, it's different since Obergefell. But ever since, one thing that I found fascinating about this particular case is that when this charge was made and when Jack Phillips refused to make the cake for this gay couple, gay marriage was still illegal in Colorado. And that's one thing that I found just an interesting little tidbit about this case.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And that's another... I think that's another part of the reason why the Supreme Court could potentially punt on this case if they don't mm-hmm. want to tackle the big issue. So the way that they're framing it, they're framing this as discrimination based on sexual orientation. Now,
right.
In Colorado at the time, they did have a statute saying you can't discriminate on the basis of sexual orientation, but they also had a marriage amendment in place saying in Colorado, marriage is between one man and one woman.
Right.
So that's one thing that, you know, Phillips, you know, brought up. He says, look, at the time I did this, gay marriage was not legal in this state. So what are you getting on me for? But you know, the lower courts, I think they really
exactly.
stretched out that you know sexual orientation statute far beyond what it was intended to do.
Yeah, I saw this New York Times interview with Jack Phillips, and he actually said in that interview that he had when this couple came in requesting a wedding cake, he offered to make them other things. It wasn't that he wouldn't make them a cake; it was that he wouldn't make them a wedding cake. And so that was part of the issue. And furthermore, he also said that my policy prevents me, because of my religious beliefs, from making any wedding cakes, Halloween cakes, or adult theme cakes.
Mm.
So my question is, and I'd never even thought of this angle before he brought it to my attention, let's just say for the sake of argument that this case goes through, is there potentially a legal way that now courts could also require a cake designer to make adult theme cakes or Halloween cakes or something, and they can't use religion as a out for that?
That's a good thought, Caleb. Off the top of my head, I think the short answer in my mind would be no. In this particular case, you had a Colorado statute that said you can't discriminate on the basis of sexual orientation. So, that's really where the lower court based its decision off of. So, but it would be odd if the Supreme Court held you can opt out of all these other things, but just not that particular thing of sexual orientation. So
right, and that's the issue. Are they discriminating because these two men are gay, or is he discriminating because it was a gay wedding that he would be making the cake for? And
mm-hmm.
if that's what they decide, honestly, I wouldn't be able to see the difference in you making an adult novelty cake or a Halloween cake. I don't know if they would legally connect the dots between those two. It was just something interesting I thought of. All right, we do have a break coming up. We'll be back with more with Matt Clark and some of the other Supreme Court decisions. We'll be back.
Can't be done.
This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
Galatians 5:1. It was for freedom that Christ set us free. Therefore, keep standing firm and do not be subject again to a yoke of slavery.
Welcome back, everybody. You are listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440 and the News Radio 1440 app. 860-1440 are the numbers if you want to call in, ask Matt a question. You can also do that if you tweet us at Tactics Radio. So if you're on Twitter, at Tactics Radio would be the way to get in touch with us. If you have any questions or comments, let us know. You may have it read on the air. So we're looking at several of the Supreme Court cases. We've already looked at Masterpiece Cake Shop. I wanted to get into this one, which I found interesting. Trinity Lutheran Church. There was a 7-2 decision made on that. So give us a little background on that one, and Matt, and kind of introduce it. Let us know what this one's about.
Sure. So this case arose out of Missouri, I believe. And what happened there was you had a government program that would provide funds for businesses, organizations, people that or schools or the like who wanted to repave playground asphalt. All of us, growing up, I'm sure we all fell off the monkey bars and the swings a bunch of times, and got skin knees and other injuries. So
I guess maybe you did. No, I'm kidding.
Yeah. Well, I guess the state of Missouri wanted to try to find a way to make this safer for kids, so it had bought back a bunch of old tires that had been thrown away. And I think wanted to provide funds or the recycled used tires to people that wanted to repave the grounds for the playground. So Trinity Lutheran Church was not just a church. It also provided a daycare. And outside it had a playground with just all the standard equipment that you usually see on playgrounds. And it thought,
pretty common for modern churches.
Yeah, exactly. And so it just thought, hey, I want to get in on this. We want to make the playground safer for the kids, and this is probably the cheapest way to do it. So it applied to the state, and the state said, hey, I'm sorry, we can't do that because you're a church. And there's a provision in the Missouri Constitution that specifically says we cannot provide state funds to churches. So our hands are tied. We really can't do it. So Trinity Lutheran thinks, hang on a second. So you're telling me everybody else can get in on this except churches just because they're churches? The state of Missouri essentially says, yeah, you're right. That's exactly how it goes. So the Trinity Lutheran wound up suing, claiming that this was a violation of their rights of free exercise of religion because they were being excluded from a program just because of their religious identity. So the U.S. Supreme Court precedents governing some of these programs say that you can't exclude somebody or target them just because of their religious beliefs. All right. Yeah. So it is an interesting question because I think both at the federal and state level, the governments have grown in their function beyond what they were originally designed to do. As a pretty hardline conservative, I'm sitting here wondering, why is the state providing funding for this stuff at all? I mean, the state exists to administer justice, to protect life, liberty, and property, and that's about it. So when the state starts stepping outside of those traditional boundaries and starts getting into other things like providing funds or goods, for people, then, if the question becomes whether there's a constitutional violation if you exclude somebody just because of their religious identity or something like that. So the case comes up to the Supreme Court, and like you pointed out, Caleb, in a 7-2 decision, which is pretty rare for the court on cases like this.
Right, you had Breyer and Kagan siding with the conservatives on this.
Yeah, and then, as a miracle, Justice Kennedy woke up on the right side of the bed that morning, that was good too.
Which is a coin flip sometimes.
Yeah, just depends on how he's feeling on a given day. The court in a 7-2 decision sided with Trinity Lutheran Church. And what they had done is they walked through their old precedents on this issue, and they said, look, it's kind of black and white right now that, you cannot discriminate against or exclude an organization or a person from a program like this just because of their religious identity, all right? And you're essentially forcing them to choose between being able to take part in a program that everybody else gets to take part in at the expense of, giving up their religious identity, or the other way around, maintaining their religious identity while at the same time not getting to partake in a program. So that's what the court had a problem with. So overall, I mean, I thought it was a good decision. A lot of conservatives are hailing this as a big victory for religious liberty, and I would say it's a victory, but the much bigger case is Masterpiece Cake Shop, like we were just talking about.
I concur. Yeah.
Yeah. So there were some good writings from Justices Gorsuch and Thomas concurring. They kind of called out the court essentially for not being conservative enough with with their ruling. Surprise, surprise. Thomas called into question, some of the wacky precedents that had been relied on, but he said, I'll kind of go along with this because nobody's asking us to reconsider it right now. Maybe this isn't the purest reasoning here, but I'll go along with it for now. And Gorsuch comes along and says, my problem with the court's decision is that they're drawing a distinction based on, your status versus your acts, right? Saying like the court held that you can't discriminate against this church because they have the status of a church. But the court did go on to discuss the differences between just your status as a church versus doing religious activities. And Gorsuch is scratching his head saying, all right, number one, if you adopt this framework, you can look at the exact same set of facts and a crafty lawyer can frame it one way or another, so I don't know how sound this reasoning is. And then he also went on to say, I don't see why the free exercise clause should care. It says you have the right to free exercise exercise of religion, you know, not just the status of being a religious organization, but also to carry it out, you know. So, for instance, if Trinity Lutheran wanted to adjust this playground, not just for sake of taking care of kids, but also as a means of, say, spreading the gospel, right? You know, and they were very upfront about that. Gorsuch says, you know, the free exercise clause doesn't care. You know, they should be protected with that too, as opposed to being
protected. Especially considering evangelism is actually part of the exercise of most religions.
Bingo. And even Justice Sotomayor, very liberal, you know, an Obama appointee, in her dissent, she pointed that out too. She went on to say that things like evangelizing, you know, that is free exercise of religion. So that was a good line from her. But anyway, so this Trinity Lutheran case, it was a good decision. Again, I'm just kind of thinking, you know, part of the problem here is government has grown beyond where it should. So now you come to this question of, all right, if you are going to have like a subsidy program or something, can you exclude a religious organization just because they're religious? And you know, the court in a 7-2 decision said no, you can't do that. So that was good.
Yeah, I personally. My first thought was kind of similar to what you were saying near the beginning of your analysis there. Personally, I don't even think that this program should exist. I don't think that the state should be involving themselves in kids' playground equipment anyway. However, if they're going to do it, then they don't need to be discriminating against religions to do so. But I thought about this, and I always try to think about what the implications for this would be later. Do you think personally that this decision and the logic and the reasoning that they used to get to this decision might extend to, for example, school voucher programs for a religious school? Just something off the top of my head.
Yeah, off the top of my head, I think, you know, I'm thinking that it would. Because again, even with the voucher program, you know, I have mixed feelings on that. You know, my
as
thought,
do I.
Yeah. My thought is, you know, neither the federal nor the state government should be involved in education. All right, I don't see why this is a state function. So you should get out. But with the current system that we have right now, you know, you have compulsory education where, you know, everybody has to go to a public school unless you know opt out. So the voucher system would be a way of, you know, weakening that and maybe, you know, taking a step towards where you eventually want to get to, of just really giving, you know, parents the freedom to, you know, educate their kids in the way that they see fit, and you get the state out of it altogether. But yeah, I think there have been some legal fights over the constitutionality of some of these state vouchers, and some of the liberal groups out there, like the ACLU and Southern Poverty Law Center, you know, they're claiming that this is a violation of, you know, separation of church and state. So there was one part of the Trinity Lutheran opinion towards the end where the Supreme Court considered that argument, and they said, no, under the facts of these cases, like, if we have to weigh, you know, the church's interest in free exercise of religion versus the potential Establishment Clause violation, the free exercise clause heavily outweighs any Establishment Clause violation, you know, that might be present here. So, yeah, I would think that same logic would apply to school vouchers. It does bother me a little bit that the court got into this kind of balancing test, because what that presumes is that the Constitution is incoherent, you know? Like, it presumes that there's a contradiction between the Free Exercise Clause and the Establishment Clause, and there's not. And the only reason we're there is because the court's been making bad decisions since about the 1940s.
And that's one of the problems that you're running into, is sometimes when they're having to consider these, they're looking at both legal precedent and the strict letter of the law, mm-hmm. whereas I would rather them just look at the letter of the law and not ignore legal precedent, but certainly look at that as something that is heavily outweighed by the strict wording of the Constitution.
Amen to that. Yeah. Look at what the words actually say. Imagine that, right?
Yeah, that's a weird legal philosophy that you've got there, Matt, but one I think we could use more of. We're going to go ahead and take a break here in just a second. On the Trinity Lutheran thing, just real quick, if you could give a summary, why do you think this case matters to the average person in their church?
Let me see. It reaffirms that the government cannot discriminate against either a religious institution like a church or a religious person just because they're religious. So, you know, in an age where religious liberty is coming under fire, I think the average American would find that pretty reassuring.
So theoretically, if the state is trying to issue funds or something similar to this, they could discriminate against a group of people for other reasons, but not because they're a religious institution.
That's correct.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much, Matt Clark of the Foundation of Moral Law, joining us to talk about some of the decisions and some of the news that's coming out of the Supreme Court this week. We've got him back for another segment. We'll be right back. Same old.
old song. Just a drop of water in an endless sea.
This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
To the distinguished character of Patriot, it should be our highest glory to add the more distinguished character of Christian, George Washington.
Welcome back. You are listening to Tactics with Caleb Colquitt on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com. And coincidentally enough, I am Caleb Colquitt, so it's good to be back with you. 860-1440 are the numbers. If you want to tweet us, ask a question, you can do that at Tactics Radio. Getting used to the new moniker there. And, you know, the conversation in the last commercial break is a perfect example of why we don't do a podcast where people can hear what we're saying in the commercial break. But I'll just leave you with a question mark over your head for those of you in the audience that are wondering about that. I wanted to talk about this other case, and we have Matt Clark of the Foundation for Moral Law with us. Now, I don't even know if I'm saying the name right, but because I've only seen articles about it. I haven't seen any TV coverage of it. Peruta versus California. Am I saying that correctly?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. Mic him up there, Joe. Okay. So on this particular case, it has to do with California's concealed carry ban. And I was really surprised about this one because they actually opted not to hear it. And I was wondering if you could explain a little bit why that was the case.
You know, the court didn't explicitly state its reasons, but, you know, Justice Thomas was asking the exact same question when he read a pretty powerful dissent.
Which he was joined by Gorsuch on.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So this is a pretty sad case. California, like a lot of very liberal states, such as Maryland, where I grew up, has pretty much a flat-out prohibition on carrying, whether open or concealed carrying. And it has a statute saying unlike Alabama, where, you know, it's a shall issue state, you know, you get a concealed carry permit unless there's good cause to deny you. It's the other way around in California. You can't carry unless there's very good cause for it. So
right. Good cause is actually the sticking point that they say you have to show something that distinguishes you from the rest of the population in order to receive a concealed carry permit.
Bingo. Yeah, that's absolutely right. Mr. Peruta here sued and claimed that this was a violation of his Second Amendment right to not to keep arms, but to bear it. And if you look at the text of the Constitution, which I think the Supreme Court should do more, lo and behold, it says that there's not only a right to keep arms, but also to bear them. So in 2008, the U.S. Supreme Court came out with a very big gun decision, Heller versus District of Columbia.
Right.
And it was written by Justice Scalia, for the most part, a very good opinion. And when it was talking about what bear arms mean, you know, he came to the very common sense conclusion after going back to founding era dictionaries and things like that, that bear means actually you have the right to carry arms in case of confrontation with another person.
Mm-hmm.
So Peruta is picking up on this and saying, look, all right, you might be able to, you know, either allow open carrying or allow concealed carrying while denying one or the other, but you can't cut off both, okay? And not only is this a violation of my right of the Second Amendment, but it goes exactly against what the Supreme Court said in Heller. So it came up to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, one of the worst federal circuit courts in the country, and they actually punted. They couldn't really wrestle with his logic. So what they said was, well, technically, you only challenged the concealed carry part. You didn't, you know, challenge open carry. So we're going to punt on that. So it comes up to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court decides not to take the case like you were talking about. So it was very sad because it seems to me to be a very black and white issue, and it's obviously very important. You know, out of all the rights that our Constitution protects, then arguably you have no stronger right than the right to life. And that right is no good if you don't have the ability to protect it. You know, that's why, you know, you need the right to you need the right to carry. And so Justice Thomas pointed that out in his dissent. He says, look, this is a very important right here. It's necessary for the protection of people's lives. And you guys are just punting on this. He also went on to say that a lot of the lower courts, both at the federal and state level, are pretty much defying what the Supreme Court said in Heller in its 2008 decision. You know, Thomas says, we were very black and white about this, about what the right to bear arms means. It's really the right to carry arms in case of confrontation with another person. And there's been court challenge after court challenge saying, I have a constitutional right to carry. And a lot of the lower courts are just, you know, finding ways around Heller. So
It's funny when you say that because Justice Thomas and Gorsuch did issue that dissent, and I believe – did Alito join them on that as well?
No, he did not. It was just Thomas and Gorsuch.
So it was just Thomas and Gorsuch. Mm-hmm. And one of the dissents that – one of the things they wrote in their dissent was that there is a disturbing trend amongst courts considering the Second Amendment a disfavored right. So they'll think mm-hmm. of it as a right, but it's like a lesser right than free speech and, you know, privacy and all those things.
Yeah, absolutely. Thomas pointed that out towards the end of his dissent. He says, look, we took something like about, you know, we've taken about 20, I can't remember the exact number, I want to say about 26 cases, you know, in recent years regarding First Amendment rights and Fourth Amendment rights, and those areas of the law are very well developed. But, you know, by declining to address the Second Amendment, we really are treating it as a less important right than some of the others enumerated in the Constitution. You know, Thomas thought that's just bad practice. But then in addition, you consider what's at stake here. It's the protection of people's lives. So that's all the more reason why you shouldn't treat it as a second class right.
One thing that I thought was funny about this, and you brought it up and hinted at it just a little bit, is that it seems as though that especially when it comes to not only in the judicial side, but liberals in general, they really like federalism until it comes to one of their key issues, like gun control. Like they don't like federalism. They don't like states doing their own thing. They like centralized government power. Well, until all of a sudden it comes to something like Heller, and they want to be able to essentially curtail decisions like that and say, no, you don't really have a right to bear arms.
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, you know, the Constitution affords the state, you know, a lot of reserve powers. But then, you know, that's why we have a Bill of Rights. And it's because there are certain individual rights the government can't, you know, can't trample on despite the will of the majority. And of course, that was applied to the states, you know, through the 14th Amendment. But it is strange. A lot of the liberals, both on the Supreme Court and on, you know, lower federal courts are saying, well, we need to back off and just let the people decide how they want to address this. Now, all right, if it's not specifically addressed in the Constitution, then they're absolutely right. You know, if it's not addressed there, then the people have the right in each state to decide how they want to do things for themselves. But if the Constitution says the right to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed, then it doesn't really matter what the majority of people think in one of these liberal states. You know, if you're an American citizen, you have the right to keep and to bear arms, even if the majority of people in your state don't like it.
Well, now, I have been unable to do this, and since you have a lot more training and a lot more experience when it comes to constitutional law than I did, I wanted to ask you this. Can you think of another right that you first must have to prove to your state government that you have a good cause to exercise that right before you get to use that right?
That's an excellent question, Caleb. Off the top of my head, I would say no. Sometimes the courts kind of push the envelope a little bit, even with things like free speech rights. You know, mm-hmm. sometimes you know they have upheld the constitutionality of laws, saying you need a permit first. You know, most of the time they say, okay, the requirements for that have to be pretty light. But you know, but they definitely single out the Second Amendment as one that doesn't really apply the same way, and it's pretty sad.
Yeah, with John Stossel, very prominent kind of libertarian journalist, works for Fox News, he's done a lot of work in there. He tried to apply for a concealed carry permit or just to have a gun in the state of New York. And, I mean, he's a celebrity. There's a lot of people that might want to off him, and mm-hmm. even they wouldn't give him one after $400. His application was still rejected. So there are a lot of these states where it's darn near impossible to even have a gun.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, that being said, can you stay with us for another couple segments, Matt? Do you have time?
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, excellent. We'll be back with more with Matt Clark. Hour 2 coming up.
This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
We just need a strategy, okay?
Okay, here's the plan.
We return with more on the Supreme Court decisions with Matt Clark. Welcome back, all. You're listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440 and the News Radio 1440 app. Having more fun than I should be allowed to have. Glad to be with you this morning on a Thursday. And we do have a special treat for you today for those of you who may be just now joining us at the top of the hour. We have Matt Clark of the Foundation for Moral Law. And he has been with us, giving us a discussion on some of the big news coming out of the Supreme Court this week. If you happen to miss it, don't worry, we've got you covered. In a couple hours, you'll be able to check it out on tacticsradio.com. Check out all the podcast action that we've got there. Got all our episodes there, so if you want to listen to anything from this week, be sure to check that out. They're all there. Now, we've been talking a lot about three really big, I would say almost landmark Supreme Court cases. And I wanted to ask you about this other one that doesn't really get so much into religious liberty, but certainly deals with the culture war that we've got going on, Parvin versus Smith. And what this one specifically deals with is, and you can give the details in the background here in just a second, but it has to do with same-sex couples and the quote-unquote rights that were created for them through the Supreme Court case Obergefell. So go ahead and give us an introduction and explain what this case is about to us.
Sure. I'm just going to ask you to do me a favor. If you see me starting to tear my hair out while I talk about this, please stop me, because this is a pretty frustrating one. So what happens in this case, you were right, it involved same-sex marriage, and it was a case coming out of Arkansas. So what happens here is you've got a quote-unquote married couple. You know, I don't mean to be sarcastic, but I don't believe in same-sex marriage, so I kind of have to find some way to qualify that when I
talk about it. No, I just say air fingers quotes.
All right, there you go. The two of them decide that they want to have a child. So one of them gets a child from an anonymous sperm donor, goes through artificial insemination and right. And has a kid. And then so what they wanted to have happen was they have the woman who is not the mother put on the birth certificate as one of the child's parents. That's what they were shooting for here. Well, the Arkansas Supreme Court said, no, you don't have to do that. They did not defy the U.S. Supreme Court's ruling in Obergefell v. Hodges, which simply held that same-sex couples have the right to get married. But what they did was they said, all right, this is not really about marriage. It's just about the biological fact that this other woman is not the child's parent. And this is just – come on. This is just basic science. Everybody is here because of a man and a woman. You know, even if you were conceived via IVF and came from an anonymous sperm donor or something like that, you're still there because of a man and a woman. This is the way that it works. This is the way that it's always worked throughout human history. And there's no other way around that. There were several dissenting justices from the Arkansas Supreme Court that said, no, we have to get in line with Obergefell. And what they were picking up on in Obergefell was there was one line in there talking about how, not only do same-sex couples need to get married or have the right to get married, but they have to be treated on the same grounds as heterosexual married couples. So there was a brief line in there about that. But, the opinion also said that there was some room for the states to work out exactly how that's going to apply. So, of course, the majority picks up on that part saying there's room for the states to figure out how this works. And the dissenters say, no, you have to treat them equal. So it comes up to the U.S. Supreme Court. And again, I'm looking at this. I'm saying this is not even about marriage. This is about the fact that this woman is not the child's biological parent. That's it. It comes up to the U.S. Supreme Court. I really thought that they were going to declined to take the case on this one. But instead, not only did they take it, but they disposed of it in a very unusual way. So as I'm sure you know, Caleb, and I'm sure your audience knows, the typical way that the court takes up a case is that they grant what's called a writ of certiorari. It's Latin. I don't know if I pronounce that right, but nobody knows because it's Latin.
I was about to say it's a dead language. There's no correct pronunciation, so you're good.
Yeah, exactly. Right. And so that's the official thing saying we're going to go ahead and take the case. The parties show up in Washington. They have oral arguments. A lot of times it's very heated. And then, the court several months later, renders an opinion. And so it really shows the public, hey, we took up this case, we listened to it, we listened to both sides, we engaged, the attorneys, we gave them your day in court, and then, after a lot of thoughtful consideration, here's our opinion on the matter. But there is another way to knock out decisions, and it's called summary dispositions, right? This is where the court just very briefly grants cert, and in a very short opinion, turns it around. The parties don't get a chance to show up in Washington and argue in front of the judges, and so it's really supposed to be reserved for cases that are black and white, and frankly are incredibly dumb. Okay. You know, so we were talking in the last hour about a gun rights case. In two cases now, the U.S. Supreme Court has held that you have the right to keep a handgun in your home. So if a case came up to the Supreme Court where, you know, the lower court said, no, you can't keep a handgun in your home, that would be a good case for where summary disposition would be used. It's like we've addressed this very specific point before a couple of times now. You really ought to get with the program. So, no, we're just going to go ahead and reverse you real quick.
So instead of listening to a bunch of arguments that where the case is so similar to another one they've already decided on, it was essentially be them just plowing ground they've already plowed before. They give one of these summaries and say, yeah, this is something that we don't even really want to hear again. It's obvious.
Yeah, exactly. And then so, you know, because of the potential for abuse here, that should be reserved for cases that really are that obvious.
Right.
But here, that's the court used summary disposition to knock out this Pavin case. I don't really know how this is pronounced. Pavin. You know, I'm going to go with Pavin. It was a per curiam opinion, meaning we don't really know who the author was. It's kind of sad when that happens sometimes because, you know, you're not really sure who to hold accountable here as, you know, the mastermind behind the opinion. But they essentially said, look, we talked about in Obergefell, you need to treat same-sex married couples the same way that you treat opposite-sex married couples. So clearly, you know, you need to put the name of, you know, the other, you know, spouse on the child's birth certificate. Justices Alito, Gorsuch, and Thomas dissented on this. And I believe Gorsuch was the one who wrote the dissent, and he had some very good points. Number one, he talked about how the fact that this is not obvious at all, okay? In Obergefell, you know, the court held that same-sex couples have the right to get married, but it did not address things like, you know, whose name needs to go on a birth certificate, especially when, for goodness sake, it is a biological fact that this other spouse is not, you know, the biological parent of that child.
And if I'm not mistaken, actually the cases like this that pertain to this are one of the things that Thomas predicted would happen in the Obergefell dissent, if I'm not mistaken.
I'm having trouble remembering which...
I mean, it was a vague prediction. He said that this opens up essentially a can of worms to a lot of other things. And I'm not saying he predicted this specifically. But he did warn a little bit about this when issuing that opinion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a lot of the dissenters in Obergefell, I think three out of the four of them, you know, predicted that there was an inevitable clash with religious liberty. And then some of them went on to, you know, lay out some of the other consequences that you were talking about. So, yeah, they were right, and it's starting to happen. This is not really the kind of case that you use a summary disposition for. So, in plain English, the Supreme Court won through cheating. That's what they did.
Taking kind of the lazy way out. All right. Well, thank you so much, Matt. Thank you for that. We'll be right back in just a moment.
What it takes to bridge the great divide.
This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
Philippians 3:20. For our citizenship is in heaven, from which also we eagerly wait for a Savior, the Lord Jesus Christ.
Welcome back, everyone. You are listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com. We have spent the majority, actually all of the morning, talking to Matt Clark of the Foundation of Moral Law. We're glad to have him with us talking about some of the important cases that are coming out of the Supreme Court, because this does apply to us. We are going to get back to that in one moment, but I did want to mention beforehand that you have the opportunity to win $4,000 to spend your way in our Red, White, and Win contest, brought to you by American Oak and More. You don't pay with fake money, so don't settle for fake wood. Celebrate Independence Day with $4,000 in your pocket right now. Enter for your chance to win at newsradio1440.com. And don't forget our good friends at Southside Firestone Tire and Auto Center. Been with them a long time, and the reason that I've been with them a long time and the reason that a lot of their customers have been with them for a long time, decades in some cases, is because they're reliable, people know them, they're very good at what they do. Any problem that you've got with your automobile, you bring it in, even if you have to have it towed in, which, by the way, they will take care of for you. They have a service, and they'll just charge you along with your bill. So incredibly easy. You're only going to have one thing to deal with, one thing to pay for when it comes to Southside Firestone Tire and Auto Center. They make things easy for you. They work with your insurance company if that's something that is involved in it. So whether you need major engine repair or an oil change, or maybe just need to buy some new tires, be sure to do that before your family goes on summer vacation, because you do not want to be stuck on the side of the road halfway between here and Gulf Shores trying to figure out what to do with your car. Take it to Southside Firestone Tire and Auto Center. Get it checked out there first. They're on the Troy Highway right here in Montgomery. So, we're back with Matt Clark of the Foundation for Moral Law, a constitutional specialist, and he's talking to us about some of the cases. Before we move on, I did want to mention a couple things in the case that we were just mentioning that had to deal with gay couples and whether or not they can be put on the birth certificate for a child in this particular case that had to do with artificial insemination. Apparently, according to what I was reading, the sticking point here was that Arkansas law requires the birth mother's husband to appear on the birth certificate, even if he's not the biological father when it comes to artificial insemination. Is that correct?
Yes, it is. Now, if I'm if I'm looking at this correctly, one of the problems in this lawsuit is that the gay couple did not challenge that particular statute. They challenged another one. So Gorsuch brought up in his dissent, like, all right, you know, this would have made a little bit more sense if you would have challenged that particular statute and said it's being applied unequally. But you're not, you know. So it's a case of sloppy lawyering, which is all the more reason why, you know, you shouldn't have knocked this out through a summary disposition, because it's not really black and white at all.
So you're saying in theory that could have been a very strong argument for them, but that's not what they challenged anyway, so it shouldn't be considered in this decision.
That's absolutely correct.
So just wondering, do you think taking – let's just take the morality of gay marriage out. Like, let's – you know, because of course you and I believe that marriage is between a man and a woman. Let's take that away from the case just for a second for the sake of argument. Couldn't legal adoption accomplish essentially the same goal? Like, it wouldn't be on the birth certificate, but as far as being a legal guardian of a child – can't you legally adopt someone that way? Wouldn't that accomplish the same thing?
You know, I hate to do this, Caleb, but I'm going to punt on that question because I really don't know that much about adoption law specifically.
Gotcha.
But I think it really depends from state to state, you know, with the particular scheme that they've, you know, set up. And it is a question about whether, you know, same-sex couples can adopt or not. I know there's been some court fighting about that. But
right here in our own state, actually.
Yeah, that's true. Because it's not my area of expertise, I'm not going to get too much into that.
Well, now, Laura, you specialize in family law. Did you want in on this, or?
I can't.
Okay, yeah. Well, let's bring Laura.
That's me.
Yeah, Joe, just transfer your mic to her. There you go.
All right, Joe. Okay, so I know a little bit about family law. Not a lot, but it does. It depends on the state. In Alabama, you probably could now adopt, and it would, in a way, say do the same thing. You get the same legal rights, but that is a hard process to go through. On top of that, it's sometimes it doesn't transfer everything that they want on there. So, in other words, with adoption, I can easily take this away. I can take these rights. They're kind of more flimsy. If I'm on your birth certificate, you've got to go through a process. It's going to be a little bit harder to do. So, yes, you could. Is that what they want? No. And honestly, they really don't want it that way just because they want all of those rights, even if they, you know, even if they shouldn't have it.
Right. And that was the issue that – one of the issues that I had with this case in general is that when you're talking about biological parents, you know, it always takes a mother and a father to produce a child. And so I think that a lot of the pitfalls that we're seeing here – could be reconciled if the name on the birth certificate were the biological parents. Now, granted, if you're talking about family law, that opens up a whole other can of worms that would have to be addressed. So I'm not saying we just overnight change the law to that, but maybe look into that a little bit just to see if maybe that would solve some of the headaches and there would be some legal ways to adjust that. Just an idea I'm throwing out there. It's not one that I've considered for a lot of time because, again, I just started studying this particular case last night. So it's not something that I've considered a lot of, but I'm thinking maybe that would be a direction that we could look into. I think that really the significance of this is that the court's opinion all had to lean upon a fabricated right that the court essentially made out of whole cloth in the Obergefell decision.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. You know, with the Supreme Court just made that write up out of thin air. The dissents beautifully demonstrate how bad the legal reasoning was. You know, and even if you agree with the conclusion, you read the opinion, it should make you want to do a facepalm. You know, Justice Scalia had a great line in his dissent. He said, "Even if, as a price to be paid for joining this case, I had to be the fifth vote, I would hide my head in a bag." The court has descended from the disciplined legal reasoning of John Marshall and Joseph Story to the mystical aphorisms of the fortune cookie,
which was my favorite line in his opinion. That's why I miss Scalia so much, because his opinions were so well written.
But
you're absolutely right. They essentially just created a right that had never existed before at any time, not only in American history, but in the vast majority of it, world history. You know, nowadays we are the first society. Homosexuality has been around a long time.
Mm-hmm.
We are the first society that said homosexuals can be married. Marriage can be between two men or two women. I mean, even the ancient Greeks, where homosexuality was rampant, they never thought to say, hey, we're married now. And so it's interesting that culturally we're really the first society that has decided that. And when I say society, I mean Western society, not necessarily America specifically. But it's interesting to think about it from that. And this is one of the big pitfalls of having these manufactured rights that they just pulled out of nowhere. So we won't spend as much time on this one because it doesn't have as much to do with religious liberty, but I was really surprised about this one. The travel ban, Donald Trump's travel ban, which I'm sure that most of our audience is aware of, the one that had to do with the six Muslim countries. This is the second travel ban, by the way, that they made this decision on. The six Muslim countries saying with the refugee crisis, hey, let's take a pause, see if we can figure out a way to vet these guys better, and then maybe come back and allow it at a later time. Interestingly enough, the Supreme Court upheld the vast majority of this travel ban. Am I correct in that?
Well, as sort of. What they did was they decided that they were going to take the case. You had two federal courts of appeals, the Fourth Circuit, which covers Maryland, West Virginia, Virginia, North Carolina, and South Carolina.
Right.
And the infamous Ninth Circuit had both, you know, declared they had both struck down President Trump's travel ban. The Fourth Circuit said it was a violation of the Establishment Clause. In plain English, they said it was a Muslim ban is what it really is. And then the Ninth Circuit, they didn't quite go that far. They just kind of said that, well, the president exceeded the powers that were given to him over this matter on immigration.
Now, what was funny about them citing that it essentially was tantamount to a Muslim ban is in that decision, and again, you can correct me if I'm wrong, their logic stemmed not from the actual wording of the law, but from statements that Donald Trump had made during his campaign. Had nothing to do with looking at the law or the executive order itself. It had everything to do with what they think Donald Trump might do in the future based upon some things that he said in the past.
Yeah, and as you can see, I'm doing face palms here in the studio while you say that, but it's because
we don't
you're
have
right.
video feed.
Yeah.
But
again, stop me from pulling my hair out if I talk about this, okay? But you're absolutely right, and it's really pathetic the way that the courts have come to look at Establishment Clause claims. It is going down this route of really doing a very subjective psychoanalysis of what was going through the person's head at the time they made that. Yes, just a little bit of background, as I'm sure you know, Caleb, and I'm sure a lot of your audience knows, the reason why the Establishment Clause exists was to prevent the establishment of a national church. All right, you know,
right.
We had that, back when America was just British colonies, we had that with the Church of England, and most of the states had established churches as well, and the country was predominantly Christian at the time, but they just kind of thought, you know what, this really isn't the proper role of the state to get involved in this, and we want to stop a lot of the political infighting between different Christian denominations, so we're just going to pull out of this. That's what the Establishment Clause was supposed to do. Now, somehow, we have gone down this twisted road to the point where we're just trying to get inside people's heads and try to figure out, were you trying to discriminate, against somebody based on their religion? Or, just a little bit more plainly, were you trying to make somebody feel bad because of their, religious background?
And that was the thing. When it comes to religious liberty and the Establishment Clause, I think that if they knew just a little bit of history, it would change their perspective a great deal, because they weren't even saying that the states can't get involved with religion. In fact, at the time of the Establishment Clause's ratification in the Bill of Rights, there were four states that actually had state churches at the time, and that was deemed perfectly constitutional and in concert with the First Amendment. It's just the Fed that could not get involved with an establishment of religion. So a lot of interesting things there. We'll be back in just a moment.
This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
A watchful eye must be kept on ourselves, lest, while we're building ideal monuments of renown and bliss here, we neglect to have our names enrolled in the annals of heaven. James Madison.
Hey everybody, welcome back to Tactics with on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com. We're here with Matt Clark of the Foundation for Moral Law. And one of the things that I wanted to bring up, and it's funny because we had planned this to be an hour, and there's just so much to talk about, so much volume to go through.
You're giving a lawyer a chance to talk. This is what's going to
happen. Right, I know. Well, I mean, I'm a talk show host, so obviously I'm kind of in the same boat. And when you get both of us together, then we just tend to ramble a little bit. But but no, it's been good. It's been informational, and I think that there's a lot of people in the audience that are really interested in some of these cases. When looking back at some of these, and I wanted to talk a little bit more about the travel ban, the way that it works right now, at least procedurally, and I understand why people were upset about this. Now, I understand the reasoning, but I think you could probably do a better job at explaining it to the audience than maybe I could. A lot of people, especially on the Trump side, were incredibly frustrated that a federal judge can essentially say, no, we're not going to go ahead and do the executive order basically by himself and without even having an actual case or a court decision say we're going to strike down this even though the travel ban was something in an emergency situation. Now, I understand the legal reason why that's in place, but if you could explain to the audience why that procedure takes place.
Well, let me see. If you want to be technical about it, I do think there was a case in front of some of these federal judges. In the one coming out of the Ninth Circuit in Hawaii, there is a guy who was
That one actually had a case attached to it.
Right. Yeah, that one was a Muslim imam, and you know, he was claiming, hey, my wife can't come. And then the state of Hawaii said, you know, we've granted scholarships to some students coming from these countries, and you know, they can't come now, so that's why we're going to go ahead and challenge this. A little hazy on the facts of the Fourth Circuit case, so maybe that was a little bit more in line of, you know, what you were talking about. I think we can all agree here that there is a tremendous potential for abuse of power by some of these judges.
And true, just, yeah.
Yeah, what you were talking about.
Whether what they did is legal or not, there's mm-hmm. That doesn't change the fact that it could be abused.
Right. If you take this, you know, logic to its conclusion here, it's a very dangerous precedent when a court can start stepping in and start dictating what the president can and can't do in a national security situation. Now, obviously, yes, the Constitution does apply to the president as well, and so therefore there are, you know, there are some contours here. You know, I think we can all agree that if let's just say, for example, just use like the extreme example here, if you know, the president decided that he was going to send, you know, all Jews to concentration camps in the name of national security. It's like, okay, well, I think we can all agree, number one, that's morally egregious. But then second, you know, you're sitting here scratching your head wondering, what's the constitutional basis for that? And especially with the political climate as it is, you know, right now, it's like, if there is no evidence at all that these people are posing some kind of a threat, then yeah, you absolutely cannot do that.
It's not like that would ever happen in America. Well, you know, except for FDR did.
Uh-huh, Korematsu, but yep. exactly. So there is this balance that you have to strike between, you know, deferring to the president on national security matters, but also just providing a little bit of a check here. So the cardinal rule that was laid down in a 1972 case called Clyde and Stite, I think I pronounced that right, versus Mandel, is that if the president has a facially legitimate and bona fide justification for protecting national security, then mm-hmm. that's good enough for the court. You know, so it doesn't really matter, you know, a lot of times what the president's, you know, ulterior motive might be. Like if you have even if the president has, you know, a nefarious reason for imposing like a travel ban in place, let's just say hypothetically in his heart of hearts, Trump really did hate Muslims and he wanted to kick, you know, Muslims out of the country. As bad as that would be, you know, if he can say, all right, you know, I do have like a legitimate secondary reason that there is a national security problem here. You know, there's a huge influx of terrorists coming from these seven countries. The court should look at that and say, all right, you know, you might be a bit of a bigot, but legally there's nothing we can do about that.
Right. And that's the difference that I think people really need to grasp and fully understand. laws are not made by perfect people. So, yes, occasionally they will have bad intent, but we can't necessarily look at what's in their heart. We have to look at what the law says. And that was the issue that I had with the Fourth Circuit decision.
Yeah, excellent point, Caleb. And you know, even the Fourth Circuit's decision, they cited rules from the Supreme Court saying, okay, you're not really supposed to look into the lawmakers or the president's heart of hearts, is what he says. You're not supposed to go exploring that. But really, that's in practice exactly what they did.
Right. Just sort of playing the other side of this. Let's say, for example, that the Supreme Court had ruled against Obamacare, and their logic for doing so, because I think they should have ruled against Obamacare for other reasons, but their logic in doing so was, well, President Obama clearly has very Marxist tendencies, and what he actually wants to do eventually is to take us to a single-payer system. Mm-hmm. Now, even though I think Obamacare should be struck down, and I do think that he actually did want to move us to a single-payer system, that does not change the fact that that is not what this law was.
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. It's not enough to get to the right conclusion. You got to get there the right way. Mm-hmm. And when you start losing that, that's really where you start losing the basis for the rule of law. You know, George Washington, this is one of Chief Justice Moore's favorite Washington quotes. He said, you know, I can't quote verbatim like Chief Justice Moore can. That man's
a
genius.
Do a paraphrase.
Okay, yeah, we're going to have to do a paraphrase here. This is the message version. He said, if the American people find in any way that the distribution of powers in the Constitution is undesirable, then let them change it. But let them do so according to the method prescribed by the Constitution. Because although it might seem in this one instance that it's your salvation that you change it by usurpation, it is a customary weapon by which free governments are destroyed. You know, so he said, you know, the evil that you set by that precedent greatly overbalances any good that you accomplish in that one instance. So that's
right. It goes back to a saying. Mine is much more simple because I'm not nearly as intelligent as George Washington. But mine is, how you win matters.
That's good.
You want to get a victory, but you got to get there the right way. And so kind of going back and setting with that, that's actually similar to what Justice Gorsuch recently said in an opinion where he said, I forget exactly what the case is. I actually covered it, I think, yesterday or the day before. Mm-hmm. We were talking about Justice Gorsuch and his performance so far, the ideas that he's come out with in his short time as a Supreme Court justice. And he said, they're asking us to tweak this particular constitutional provision. It had to do with the Census Bureau, the case that they heard about that, the Census Bureau employee. He said, they're asking us to tweak one of these provisions just a little. If there is a bad law, there is a way to get around that. It's called legislation.
Bingo. Yep.
And I mean, Gorsuch is 100% right. And I think that shows that Gorsuch does not think that he's a legal activist. He thinks of himself as a interpreter of the law, which is what he's supposed to do.
Yeah, I agree with you completely. I'm having trouble remembering the case name and everything, but I remember reading that line that you were talking about, and it was pretty solid statement of what the role of the judiciary is. It's not the judiciary's job to rewrite laws or to amend them. That belongs to the legislature, but it's the court's job to interpret and apply the law as it stands. So
I'm pretty sure I gave a fist pump when I saw that when I was reading it in the article that I was researching. But yeah. No, I mean, it is encouraging, and really at the core of the judicial system is the idea, or at least it used to be, we're supposed to be looking at what the law says and interpret it correctly, not make the laws ourselves. And that's one of the issues that I know I'm going a lot broader than probably the limited discussion that we were intending on having today, but that's one of the issues I think we've had in this country for quite some time now, is we've got both the executive branch and the judicial branch making laws, mm-hmm. which they were never supposed to be able to do.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's part of the reason why you have separation of powers and why it's so fundamental to the American system of government. Experience showed us when we were founding our country that when you consolidate these powers, tyranny arises very, very easily. And it's because the founders, they had a very Christian understanding of what the nature of man is. As much as it would make me feel good to say we're naturally good, we're not. We all of us inherited a sinful nature. And we have a dark side to us. Now that doesn't mean that we do the wrong thing all the time, but it does mean that we inherited a bent towards evil. So when you get power in your hands, you're going to be naturally bent to abuse it. So the founders recognized this. Madison in Federalist 51 is probably one of the greatest of the Federalist Papers.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Said if men were angels, no government would be needed. And he was absolutely right. So recognizing that, he said that's why we got to separate the powers and make them fight each other. Because
I actually think that that idea that Madison portrays probably comes from the first chapter of Common Sense, where Thomas Paine said essentially he separates society and government and says that the two should never be confused. Government or society exists as a result of man's inherent goodness. Government exists to prevent man and restrain his vices. So you see that difference there, and really what that all goes back to. It's a fundamental difference in understanding that society and government are different and have different roles. And so, absolutely. Thank you so much for being with us this morning, Matt. I've really appreciated it. You're welcome back anytime.
Oh, thanks, Caleb. It was great being with you.
All
thanks
right.
for the opportunity.
Thank you so much. Matt Clark of the Foundation of Moral Law. Chaplain's Report coming up.
Touch of a precious child and no mother's love. It's funny how it's a little thing.
This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
Matthew 22:37-40. And he said to him, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind. This is the great and foremost commandment. The second is like it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. On these two commandments depend the whole law and the prophets."
Welcome back. You're listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440 and the News Radio 1440 app. It's time for the Chaplain's Report. And for those of you who have been listening all week, and if you have missed a part of this series, you can check them all out at tacticsradio.com or Tactics Radio US, because, you know, we're patriotic. So either way, it'll get you to the right place. So we've been going through the first chapter of John, and like I've said so many times, I may have even said it every time this week, but it bears repeating. The first chapter of John is so incredibly thick. I could spend months worth of Chaplain's Reports on this one chapter and still wouldn't exhaust it. So there's a wealth of wonderful spiritual symbolism, philosophy, theology, the introduction of the character of Jesus Christ, not only as a person who actually physically walked the earth, but also as an idea, as an origin, as deity. All of those things are contained within the first chapter of John, and we're going to cover four verses of that this morning. "And the Word," speaking about Christ, of course, "and the Word became flesh and dwelt among us, and we saw his glory, glory as of the only begotten from the Father, full of grace and truth. John testified about him and cried out, saying, 'This is he of whom I said, he who comes after me has a higher rank than I, for he existed before me. For of his fullness we have all received, and grace upon grace. For the law was given through Moses, grace and truth were realized through Jesus Christ. No one has seen God at any time, the only begotten of God, who is in the bosom of the Father, he has explained him." One of the most interesting phrases in this particular passage to me has always been "the Word became flesh," because that has so many far-reaching implications. Off the top of my head, and for the sake of time, we won't go into any others, but there's two obvious meanings here. One's a little more obvious than the other, though. The first one is that Jesus became flesh. We've been talking about the Word. That's how the book of John starts, distinguishing Jesus, calling him the Word. That's the moniker that is given to him. So obviously you have the plain explanation of that, that the Word, Jesus Christ, became flesh. What does that mean? That he was fully human and fully God, both at exactly the same time. That yes, he emptied himself. Yes, he made himself a little lower than the angels, as we see in one of the epistles. But that he was just as much God as God and just as much human and human, and he was both at the same time. So we see Jesus Christ making himself into flesh, entering the world, and it says specifically that he dwelt among us. We see a lot of very interesting, very human episodes in Christ's life. He felt pain and sadness and hunger. He was tempted just like we were tempted. He knew what it was like to have a family, brothers and sisters, to have good friends, to have friends betray you, to have people love you and people at the same time despise you. He felt frustrated when people didn't understand what he was saying. He felt like an outcast much of the time. He felt exhaustion. He was just as human as we were. He experienced every aspect of the human experience. And that's one of the reasons that he's able to relate to us, and that's one of the reasons that we're able to relate to him, is that he lived among us. You see, we always focus on the death of Christ, and we're supposed to. That's actually biblically sound. It's good that we focus on his sacrifice and his death, but it's important, too, that we focus on his life. The examples that he left us, the teachings that he gave us. He sacrificed his life, not just a life where he came down and died and then went straight back to heaven. He sacrificed his life. He lived as a human. He had friends. He had people that he cared about. He was worried about his mom on the cross. And so he had concerns just like the rest of us. What's the second meaning there, though? Yes, the word becoming flesh meant that Jesus was human, but it also meant that Jesus, who's being referred to here as the Word, was the ultimate fulfillment of the law. The Word of God, the Law of Moses, as the Hebrew readers of this time would have understood it, became flesh. So in other words, the Law of Moses came to us in physical embodied form. Jesus was the ultimate fulfillment of that law in several ways. First of all, he was the fulfillment of it because that's what the law was always pointing to. It was always pointing to Jesus coming to earth to save us from our sins, but it was also that he was the perfect embodiment of a follower of the law. You see, we see this point made by the Apostle Paul later in Romans, that all fell short of the law at one point. Even the best Jew in the world, when following the law of Moses, would fall short occasionally, because humans are not perfect. But Jesus was. He kept the law perfectly and was the only person to ever do so. And so he was the fulfillment of the law in many senses. Look how John, both directly and indirectly, references Moses twice here. He says that the law was given through Moses, and then later in the next verse says that no one has seen God at any time. That actually is a direct reference back to the forming of the Ten Commandments, where Moses had to, when he saw God, he didn't see God's face, and that's something that's pointed out in the book of Exodus. And so there's a couple of references here back to the law of Moses. And that tells us that the purpose of the Torah, the purpose of the law of Moses that was passed down, and the Hebrew nation as a whole, it served one purpose: the coming of the Christ. The whole of Jewish history was to produce the Savior of the earth. In fact, that's the promise that God gave to Abraham, that through him all nations, not just the Jews, that all nations would be blessed by Abraham's seed. And when Abraham, eventually, his lineage did produce Jesus, and that gave us salvation of all mankind. You see, the law, as it existed beforehand, the old law, brought man closer to God. But only Jesus brought us into God. He dwelt among us as a deity and a man at the same time. The law can help us understand things about God's nature. It helped us understand his personality, who he is, the things that he expects of us, and that's all well and good. But because we can never follow it perfectly, we weren't able to have a true relationship with God the way that God intended for it until there was a actual fleshly embodiment of the law. And that came in the form of Jesus Christ. Because Jesus was the only one that kept the law perfectly, only his sacrifice, a sacrifice of the Word that became flesh, could fulfill the law's ultimate purpose. And through coming in contact with his blood, we can be justified by that law again. Stay the course, friends. Is it really fair?